Well, it's my very great pleasure now to introduce you to Jane O'Grady, who is a philosopher and who co-edited the Blackwell's Dictionary of Philosophical Quotations with A.J. Eyre, and who writes philosophical obituaries for The Guardian, is a visiting lecturer at City University, and one of the seven founders of the London School of Philosophy. Jane is going to talk to us about love from courtly to romantic, and perhaps various points that have come since then. I'm just stretching this out so we've got everybody back. And we're going to take questions not at the end of her talk, but after Candida has spoken to us about film. So, Jane.
Well, I think brilliantly already in the talk so far, there's been quite a sense of the ambivalence of love. And I think what's so interesting about what's called romantic love, and which starts, in my opinion, with courtly love, is the way that sex comes apart from love while embracing it. And that's already an ambivalence. I mean, as Yeats said, love has pitched his mansion in the place of excrement. And there is that there is that ambiguity in love, in romantic, erotic, passionate. Sorry, I'm going to run them all together. One could make, you know, fine distinction. But there is that ambiguity that it's both incredibly gross and incredibly transcendent. How do we manage that? It's the most extraordinary thing. And it's what is wonderful about human beings. Of course, just to sort of fast forward to modernity, to contemporary stuff, we spend, in one way, you know, God is dead, etc., except that he's unfortunately being revived somewhere. What we have instead of God is this sort of religion of love. And yet, paradoxically, at the same time, we do nothing but reduce it. So in one way, oh, well, the evolutionary biology angle is, oh, well, of course, romantic love is just a way of getting people to procreate. With a little bit of addition so that they stick together long enough for the birth of the first child and a little bit of child rearing. You know, that's how long passionate love is supposed to last, a year and a half. And so that's one route. The other one, which is often extraordinarily meshed with it, is the constructionist idea. You know, if love, in one way, is nature's stratagem to get us to reproduce, says Schopenhauer in the 1800s, but evolutionary biology takes that up. But in the other way, the social constructionist way, oh, love is just this sort of ridiculous concoction. It's another form of stratagem, only we rather than nature, us humans rather than nature, have concocted it. And I want to, in a way, deal more with the concoction side. I think both these attitudes that, you know, that either love is this sort of nature thing, or that it's this unnatural thing, but either way it's a stratagem, they're both very, very disappointing. But the funny thing about our stratagem love is that in one way it's like a sort of reverse of Freud's rationalization. It's actually trying to say, look, we're really wild and passionate after all, despite civilization. It's a way of sort of, you know, telling civilization to go and do something or other. You know what I mean? It's just rejecting civilization and trying to say we are wild. But anyway, when did this begin? Well, obviously, the fascinating talk about the classical love, but even in classical love, this idea that somehow Eros is lack. This comes across very much in Plato. Eros is lack. He isn't even quite a god. He's the bastard child of poverty and plenty, and we just have to really almost love through our lovers. The whole idea in the symposium that somehow each of these stages in the lover's progress, which is incredibly egoistic and solipsistic, each of these stages is a way of almost rejecting physical love, finally, and rising to the sort of pure ascetic love of beauty and goodness. A very strange idea, really. And the lovers and the stages, they are just rungs on which the lover treads. It's all about him, really. But at any rate, at least, although I always find Plato's Eros immensely unerotic, in that particular dialogue. In another one, it is a bit more erotic. And once again, there's that strange sort of fusion and departure of the gross and the transcendent. In, for instance, the Phaedrus, another dialogue of Plato's about love, he's got the idea of the sort of the winged soul. But when he describes the wing growing, it's very much, it's just impossible. You know, I don't think one has to be dirty-minded in any way in order to read it as the description of an erection, the wing becoming warm and full and stretching up, etc. And yet he's writing, you know, he's saying, better to dispense, in the very same dialogue, better to dispense with bodily love. So we've got this friction. It's not just, you know, you can't just blame the Christians. There is this friction in the ancient world between the bodily and the spiritual, even for them, although they're a bit more sort of, you know, grounded about it perhaps than Christianity was. So I'm going to flip from them across the Dark Ages when women were told that they were the gateway to the devil and also were considered, and Clement said, you know, one of the popes, that they should be ashamed just for being women. And of course, women were also, don't forget, the Eve was the gateway to the devil in the way that she'd first plucked the forbidden fruit of the knowledge of good and evil and given it to Adam. So women have this very low, well, as still in Islam, this idea that they're somehow temptresses, barriers of sin, provokers, etc. And how then do we account for this extraordinary birth of courtly love in which women come to be venerated? And also, the other progress that courtly love makes is that rape becomes outlawed. Rape is the sort of the unwritten rule, as I feel that it does seem to be in Islam, in a way that the idea is, unless women are veiled, they are game for rape. And certainly that sort of strand underlies a lot of the thinking in the Dark Ages, the Middle Ages, and so on. But I see the progress of romantic and erotic love as de-rapifying. You know, that somehow rape is outlawed and there is more reciprocity. And that's what begins to happen in courtly love. So when was courtly love? The end of the 11th century. And by the way, a further ambivalence is, did courtly love even exist? There's a lot of, you know, people have written about it endlessly. So much ink spilled. But a lot of that spilled ink is about saying, this is all a concoction by the Victorians, by the Pre-Raphaelites. And if you think that most sort of courtly love books are quite anachronistically illustrated with William Morris, Dante Gabriel Rossetti, all these people who, in fact, were living in the 19th century and seen courtly love through sanitized lenses. Because another reason for not believing in it is that, first of all, only the name amour courtois is actually introduced in 1883. Well, I think it's been used about twice before then. 1883 by a French writer who's writing about one of the courtly love texts. So, it's, you know, is this an invention? Well, in fact, the were words they had, fin amour, you know, fine love, refined love, verre amour, bon amour. So they did have words for what they're talking about. And it certainly seems to have been a very strong tradition. Another reason that there's doubt about whether it existed is because it seems to go so against what the Catholic Church demands. I mean, when I say Catholic, what was then the Christian Church? You know, again, I'm being anachronistic because it's before the Reformation. But the Christian Church is saying, and it's really tightening up at the time that courtly love began, which again might be one of the reasons that courtly love was precipitated. It's stamping down on pleasure. And Pope Gregory, who's a pope during the 11th century, says all pleasure is sinful. And he's really specifically really talking about sexual pleasure. So he clamps down on sex for... chastity for priests was only introduced in 1123, which is interesting. And before then, they were able to be married, etc. So there's that, but also people aren't allowed to be divorced. So people say, well, this just shows how could there be this open celebration of women and love and everything in these poems. Well, first of all, it isn't that open, and it isn't clear whether the whole thing isn't built on a sort of postponed gratification or endlessly deferred gratification. Whether sex actually occurs in many of the courtly love lyrics is debatable. Though, of course, in Tristan and Isolde, it absolutely blatantly does, and in Lancelot and in the stories about Lancelot and Guinevere, and in Paolo and Francesca, in Dante, etc., so who were real people. And Eloise and Abelard were also real people. So clearly there was a lot of sex, but how could it be? How could we reconcile the fact that somehow sex is exciting and wonderful? Women are reciprocal human beings who have their rights and who are actually beautiful and dignified and not just these gateways to the devil. How does this come about? Well, one way it seems to have come about. So I'm assuming that courtly love does exist, and I think even the people that write against it, write against its existence, still seem to endlessly harp on about it. So really, I think the consensus has to be there was such a movement. And this movement really seems to have been begun. All sorts of controversy about how it began. There was, because in those days, Islam was not so intolerant about sex and everything. There is, and also there's the Persian element, that there were love lyrics and so on coming over from Spain. Some people say, oh, it was because the Cathars were being... Anyway, the point is, one doesn't need to bother too much about its etiology. What happened in the 1100s was people began writing about love, and Guillaume the Ninth, who was a... He was somebody who wrote love verses and so on, and he was rather too grand to do this, but there were lots of people called troubadours in Languedoc in southern France, who were what is now southern France, who were wandering around selling their singing and their songs to the castles and the villages and so on. And of course, often these castles and villages were in the charge of women because the men had gone to fight in the Crusades. And so, therefore, they needed to please the women. So, of course, there was a lot of stuff about, oh, women are, you know, women are absolutely marvellous, etc. That can be one explanation. And also, of course, because one of the sort of tropes of courtly love is the idea of the high-born woman who's usually married. Adultery comes into it quite a lot. She's usually married. She may be a bit older than the young knight who woos her. And she is... sort of, she needs to show him pity, or not, and she is somehow of a higher class, and a greater age than him. So there's that sort of discrepancy between them. And does he ever win her? But what's so funny, and this is something that absolutely sets the, I suppose, in a way, it's a continuation of Plato's idea about Eros's lack. The fact is this postponing of gratification, this postponing of pleasure and delight. The fact that there have to be obstacles. I think apparently Freud wrote about obstacle love and how obstacle love actually sort of whips up, increases, enhances the spirit and the fervour and the energy of love. And certainly that does seem to be the case, because what's so odd about a lot of these courtly love poems is that it's almost as if there's something gratuitous and arbitrary about the setting of these terrible trials and tasks. Why set them? Well, the answer is because they're necessary so that love can be really properly whipped up. But of course, there has to be some sort of funny constructed reason for the fact that the woman sort of, and she is in the position of setting the trials very often. Now, of course, with Guinevere and Lancelot, Guinevere was the wife of King Arthur, and Lancelot one of his knights. And again, that's one of the tropes, and as in Tristan and Isolde, that feudalism is also being somehow trashed. It's not just the Christian church that is being flouted for its strictures on sex, but also feudalism, because very often this younger knight, this man who's actually a vassal of the liege lord who is married to the woman, he is betraying his lord. And yet, somehow, the poet is invariably on the side of the betrayer. This is what's so strange about courtly love. It's flouting the rules, and yet it's actually sort of rubbing its hands with glee that the rules are flouted. So with Guinevere, she was the wife of King Arthur. Lancelot was one of the knights, and one of the knights that King Arthur particularly loved. But Guinevere and Lancelot have this extraordinary, passionate love affair. And of course, it's terribly difficult for the poets. How does it end? It ends in different ways because there are endless variations on the stories. But mostly it ends with Lancelot dead and Guinevere going into a convent. You know, and also with Tristan and Isolde, what happens with them? Once again, it's the nephew who's been, I mean, he's got many, many ties, Tristan, to King Mark of Cornwall, that he's both his nephew, he's been adopted by him, he's been really well treated by him, and he's his vassal. And he goes to get Isolde to bring her back to marry King Mark, and as you all know, they drink the love potion. The love potion is their sort of alibi, it's their sort of excuse. And they drink it, and then they fall passionately in love. And the rest of this wonderful poem, well, I mean, actually there are so many different versions of it, but the rest of the story is their subterfuges outwitting King Mark and the other courtiers so that they can get together and have sex and so on. And at one point they run away. And there were very interesting variants in these stories. In one of the variants, the love potion wears off. And I think that's brilliant. Suddenly we find out, that's funny, I thought this love potion was forever, but it turns out it was probably an invention of Berul, who's writing this particular version. It turns out that it only lasted for 3 years. At the end of 3 years, they go to confession, they confess their sins to, you know, so they're saying to the church, okay, we're going to now behave properly. And they are going to part. And in fact, Mark brings her, Tristan brings her back to Mark's kingdom. And returns her. They've been in exile to the king. But it seems as if later they get together again. So it's interesting that the very thing that excused them somehow, and therefore releases them from the bonds of love, it doesn't seem to be enough. They actually somehow seek those bonds, which is very much what courtly love is about, the seeking of bonds deliberately. And one of the themes of courtly love, of course, is the garden. And the garden is always ambivalent, including in the Middle Ages, because we think, oh, the garden, you know, the natural, the growing, the so on. But the garden is cultivated. The garden is walled. The garden is secret, as the love has to be. So the garden itself, and don't forget, you know, in the Garden of Eden, the serpent entered. So it's sort of like it's reduplicating the Garden of Eden. And for instance, in the Roman de la Rose, which was a very, very much loved, courtly love text, which was begun by one Frenchman and finished by another, and is full of all sorts of satire, irony, bitterness, and heresy, really. But in this, the garden is walled off. No shepherds may go there. The walls have got all sorts of horrible sins on them, and also ugliness, old age, and so on. The sort of things that people don't want. And so it's inside the garden where we're supposed to be escaping those things. But the lover can't get into the garden at first because it's walled, and he wanders round and round. And finally he gets in. How does he get in? Through a gateway which is guarded by idleness. So again, there's the idea, look, this is a leisure activity. This is something unnecessary. You don't even need to drink a love potion. You're going to go there because you're bored. Because, in fact, you're not natural. The whole idea about it being a natural thing. No, it is constructed. It is in this garden where plants are cultivated, and they're sort of unnatural for being cultivated. Maybe some of them have been imported from other climes, and they're specially sort of pampered and so on. They're hot-housed. It's that sort of artificiality. But alongside it, and also the amour lointain, which is one of the themes of courtly love. Again, this sort of endless, we want and we don't want love. Love is the Holy Grail. The Holy Grail was another of these, of the sagas of medievalism. And the Holy Grail was itself the cup in which, the chalice in which Christ's blood was supposed to have been kept. And, you know, this very, very precious thing. And the whole of, there are various stories about the Holy Grail. There's one, an anonymous author, written in Old French and translated in the 19th century. And in this, the not Lancelot, because of course he's not, pure enough, nor Percival. It has to be a virgin. So it's Galahad, those, you know, galloping off looking for the Holy Grail, slaughtering people along the way. But the point is that the Holy Grail is endlessly, it's a real come down when he actually gets it. And similarly, it seems, with the actual gratification of love. And with this amour lointain theme, Geoffrey de Ridal, who's one of the Courtney Love poets, has this extraordinary story in which he falls in love with the Countess of Tripoli just by hearing how good she is. So he doesn't even see a portrait or have any specific descriptions of her. So he sails off to the Crusades, but his ship is wrecked off Tripoli, and he's very badly hurt. And he gets taken to an inn, and the Countess hears about him. I think this is a wonderful form of autism. After all, the Countess hears about him. She hasn't got a clue who he is. But nonetheless, she goes to the inn and she takes him in her arms and he recovers his sense of sight and sense of smell, which is extraordinary. And then he dies in her arms. She has him buried with great honours and the next day joins a convent. I mean, you know, it's so sort of quaint and medieval, but also it's incredibly sort of the male viewpoint, right? I've decided to be in love with this woman who I know not the first thing about, except that she's rumoured to be very good. I happen to be wrecked off her shores, and for some reason she turns up and she takes me in her arms, and luckily I can smell her. But you know, so it's a very strange idea, really. This all this.
Just carry on.
Okay, hold on.
What shall I do?
It's okay.
Hold on, carry on.
Okay, so I think also Courtney Love. I mean, I'm really concentrating on Courtney Love because Courtney Love, romantic love, is the final sort of stir of the souffle and the sort of swelling of it. I'll retract that metaphor immediately. But the point is that you know it comes. You couldn't have romantic love without courtly love. People like C.S. Lewis say, well, it is courtly love, just in a slightly different version. Other people say, oh no, it's completely different. But at any rate, the John the Baptist for the Christ of romantic love is definitely courtly love, and. What's also strange about it is that in courtly love, there is what's called the religion of love. So you've got, Christianity is often referred to, you know, people sort of genuflect and they go to church and they pray and all that sort of thing. Also, there are temples to Venus around the place. But also, the woman herself is worshipped like a sort of goddess very often. So, for instance, in the Knight of the Cart, which is by Chrétien de Troyes, who's one of the great French courtly love writers, Guinevere is sort of worshipped by Lancelot, and there's one point where he takes her comb and he takes the hair from it and he treats it like a relic. You know, there was this great abuse about sort of relics. So he treats it like a relic, he worships it, and he thinks that now he won't get gout or any of the ailments that he would normally get because he will be cured by this holy thing. There's another time when she's, they're both lodging in the same, lodging is the wrong word, but they're staying in the same knightly castle, and he goes up at night and he breaks the bars because of the strength of his love. He breaks the bars to get into her bedchamber, and of course he wounds himself in the process and therefore leaves blood on her sheets, which is a giveaway, and then there's all sorts of controversy about that. But when he comes into the room, all sort of having broken these bars, like some sort of, you know, mammoth hero, and he's covered with blood, but he bows before her as before an altar. He genuflects. So there is this strange sort of strain of mysticism which accompanies Christianity somehow. Christianity, you know, God is often referred to, as I say, Christ, etc., the Virgin Mary, but also this strange sort of woman worship, which is so strange after the whole business about, you know, Eve. And also what's funny is this is where Oscar Wilde is right, that art creates nature. That, of course, you've got the wonderful story of Eloise and Abelard, which almost sounds too good to be true. And you all know that the deacon, who isn't yet sworn to celibacy, teaches this young woman who's a highly a very clever young woman who doesn't have a proper education, but there he is, he's enlisted to teach her, and of course he seduces her. But it's pretty mutual, again, to do the mutuality. But of course, it's discovered because she gets pregnant. This is real life, you know, this is happening in the 1100s. And her uncle, who was actually her guardian, may possibly have been her real father, in fact, Foubert, is so enraged by this that, first of all, he wants Abelard to marry Héloïse. Abelard himself, a great philosopher. And Héloïse is absolutely wonderful, said, "I don't want to marry Abelard. It will stand in the way of his career. I would rather be his whore than the empress of the world." And this is so, I mean, what's so wonderful about this? This is where I feel that I'm almost going to end on this, that what courtly love is, it's religious in the sense that it's reverting to the innerness that the Catholic Church, with all its pomp and panoply, had actually got rid of. This is getting back to the basics of love, of sort of what you're really like, all the stuff that the Pharisees weren't supposed to be, away from the rules and rigmaroles and back to the actual pure essence. And so Héloïse saying, "I don't care, you know, don't marry me, it's fine." Anyway, the child, of course, Astrolabe, was taken into adoption. And Abelard was castrated by under the instructions of Foubert, so he also went into a monastery. And then Héloïse, there are these wonderful letters between them, which, you know, their authenticity has been disputed, but it seems pretty likely that they are genuine. And in this, you know, Héloïse is actually talking about, here she is, she's an abbess now. Not surprisingly, she got to be head of her convent. And even when she's praying in the chapel, she is thinking lustful thoughts and thinking about, and she says this to Abelard, and it's both a confession and a boast. "I think about you and what we did, and, you know, what a hypocrite I am. I'm consumed with lust while I'm praying in the chapel." But at the same time, she's saying, "And good for me and good for love." So this is what it's about, and I'll just leave you with the words, and this is what will be taken up by, first of all, in Chaucer, the brilliant, in the Canterbury Tales, they are absolutely brilliant. It's a shame they're not more done in school still. But a lot of them are about the whole getting of mastery between men and women. So in many of them, the man wants mastery over the woman. And so the patient Griselda story, in which Griselda is an absolute doormat and she does everything that her husband wants her to do, including giving away her children to be killed by him, allegedly, of course they're not. But so there's that sort of maestry where you just feel this woman really needs talking to. But anyway, so there's that. But there's also then the opposite is the wife of Bath, where she is a marvellous woman. She's been married about 5 times. She loves sex. She's terribly sort of bawdy and boisterous. And her tale in the Canterbury Tales is the tale of Gawain, who's actually raped somebody and has punishment for it. But the only way he can get out of his punishment and live is if he finds the answer to the riddle of what women want. And it transpires in the end, what women want is sovereignty over men. But so that's wonderful. But then finally, the Franklin's tale. I mean, so there are different variants of this maestry and this reciprocity in the different stories. But finally, in the Franklin's tale, there's this wonderful, absolutely sort of equal marriage in which, as Chaucer says, love cannot be constrained by maestry. And both Avaugarus and Dorigen, the husband and wife, say to one another, "Look, we will be together. We will be subject to one another, but we'll also be in control of one another. We'll both be sovereign and subject, and we will." And it's quite clear that this marriage works brilliantly. Good sex, good conversation. It's all the things one wants. But anyway, so just to leave you finally with the words, if I can find them, of from Gottfried de von Strasburg's version of the Tristan and Isolde thing. Well, I think I can remember them. It's Tristan, Isolde, Isolde, Tristan, man, woman, woman, man. And it's just, it's that sense of, you know, this is a reciprocal. What we want is reciprocity. It's not that the man should be in control of women. It's not that rape is allowed. I wanted to find one other quote, but never mind. It's that actually what we want is this joint marching together in reciprocity. And that, in a way, is what romantic love should be about. And with Shakespeare and Donne and Spenser, it gradually moves towards the romanticization of marriage as well as adultery. That also in, whereas in courtly love, the idea is, well, there can't possibly be married love, is there's no grace in married love, it's just a debt that you have to pay. Probably literally in a way, because it was, all these marriages were arranged. No, the real grace, in the sense of God's grace, in the sense of physical beauty, etc., is in adultery, where you give freely to your lover. So that idea is that then gradually transmuted into the idea that, well, you can have erotic love in marriage. And so that, you know, all Shakespeare's comedies end with the solution. And it's not just the aristocrats who pair off. It's also Jack shall have his Jill. It's also the shepherd and the shepherdess and so on. Anyway, so
thank
Tristan
you.
And Isolde, Isolde Tristan.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Jane. I know that's a huge amount to cover in a very short time, and we'll come back to some of it in conversation.
Right.
I mean, you know, the rise of the bourgeoisie alongside its views of marriage is something we can take up. But now we're going to move on to Candida Yates, who is professor of communication at Bournemouth, editor of a great and books at Karnak. I'm not going to go on and on because it will take too long, but you've got it all here. And she's got some very interesting books and a very interesting talk about male desire and
it's
cinema
the
for us.
There today, on
thank
the table, the
we hope it works. I could carry on. We could carry on talking about courtly love while you're doing this. Very interesting. I mean, you where's Jane? You didn't mention Capellanus, who I was very interested in my books, because, you know, the way he actually makes this into a form of education for civilization. This is what you need to do to be civilized, from rape to civilization. Okay.
Right, hello. We've got a few technical things going on here with showing clips and so on, and thank you for your patience, and hopefully it will all come together. Yes, my name's Candida Yates, and I'm going to talk about masculinity and the dilemmas of love, lust and longing in contemporary cinema. And I want to examine the complex interplay of love, lust, loss and frustrated desire on screen, and the implications of such complexity for fantasies of masculinity and spectatorship in cinema today. So I'm going to draw on aspects of psychoanalytic studies, film studies, cultural studies to do this. And I'm going to focus on the relationship between contemporary masculinity and in particular the ambiguities of flirtatious desire. The starting point, though, for my paper is research that I began some time ago on the relationship between masculinity, jealousy, and its representations in mainstream Hollywood cinema, mainly in the 90s and early noughties. And the wider context of that work was the prevalence of images of male suffering related to the notion of masculinity in crisis, and a broader unravelling of masculinity as a sort of psychocultural construction. Now, jealousy provides a useful lens through which to explore those dilemmas, as it tests the capacity to cope with complex emotions that arise in relation to feelings of wounded narcissism and the anxieties about separation, difference, rejection, and loss. And in 1922, Freud argued that jealousy is rooted in the search for love, but also in the loss of love. And I found that the certainties of masculinity and difference were often visibly undermined in films where different forms of male jealousy were represented, unsettling the possessive male gaze in new ways. Here are some of the films that I was looking at, often with Michael Douglas in them, actually. When faced with the spectacle of male sexual jealousy with all its cultural connotations of cuckoldry and humiliation, the film spectator may well wish for certainty and a desire for a sense of narcissistic integrity to be restored. And I wanted to know whether those images of jealous men represented a kind of rupture, a shift with what had gone before, or whether they implied a defensive shoring up of hegemonic masculinity in a new guise. So if jealousy was a useful way to frame my discussion of masculinity in crisis in the 90s and early noughties, what do images of flirtation tell us about the dilemmas of masculinity today? How might images of love, lust, and longing, and the ambiguities of flirtatious desire be used as a space in which to flirt with ideas about the dynamics of possession, intimacy, love, and attachment? So to explore these ideas, today I'm going to use the examples taken from Steve McQueen's film Shame, which I think has been on the telly a few nights a week, so some of you may have seen it, and also the film Her by Spike Jonze, which came out in 2013. And I think that these films appear to toy with the dilemmas of masculinity, lust, and longing, and represent conflicting versions of it in contemporary culture. The psychoanalytic links between jealousy, masculinity, and flirtation can be traced back to Ernest Jones, who in 1929, and it's in an essay on jealousy, he looked at the way in which flirtation may be used as a defense against the narcissistic wounds of jealousy. And one can develop Jones' ideas to explore the ways in which flirtation may be used as a way to control the other, to manage anxieties about risks of attachment and loss, and the fantasy of feminine engulfment. This relationship between flirtation and jealousy can, of course, be found in numerous novels, plays, and films, including Dangerous Liaisons, The Talented Mr. Ripley, which I've been working on with the Faction Theatre, and Mike Nichols' film Closer. And yet there's an alternative reading of flirtation which sees its radical potential as a playful way of relating to the object that evokes in its fluidity an opening for something new and a refusal of jealous sort of patriarchal authority. These different models of flirtation have different implications for cinematic representations of masculinity and also for questions of spectatorship and the flirtatious male gaze. So I want to turn now to psychoanalytic understandings of flirtation and masculinity. Now, flirtation, broadly speaking, is associated with coquetry, dalliance, and play, connoting a lack of seriousness or intention, as in the refusal to commit romantically. And in the past, classical psychoanalysis has often viewed flirtation in a negative light. For instance, in 1915, Freud links flirtation to regressive love and an inability to cope with mourning and separation. For both Freud and Ernest Jones, flirtation becomes a signifier of lightweight, superficial human relations and is aligned with the image of the coquette as the seductive, if shallow, feminine other. And Freud uses this image of flirtation to signify his distrust of America and its difference to Europe and the so-called seriousness of continental romantic relations. And he said, "It becomes as shallow and empty as, let us say, an American flirtation, in which it's understood from the first that nothing is to happen." Whoops. Yeah. Where are my slides? There we go. This is to be contrasted with a continental love affair in which both partners must constantly bear its serious consequences in mind. So since Freud, psychoanalytic thinkers, such as Adam Phillips, of course, in 1994, debated the creative potential of flirtation and its malignant flip side. At the creative level, Phillips draws on Winnicott to suggest that flirtation is a form of playful object relations, and he likens it to the interactive and transitional processes that shape subjectivity and which first emerge between mother and infant for play. And Phillips says, have I got this on the slide? From a pragmatic point of view, one could say that a space is being created in which the aims or ends can be worked out. The assumed wish for the more or less obvious sexual combinations or commitments may be a way of preempting the elaboration of, making time for, less familiar possibilities. Flirtation, if it can be sustained, is a way of cultivating wishes, of playing for time. Deferral can make room. Yet what of the sadism that can underpin the flirtatious deferral and denial of commitment? The analyst Mesler Davies argues that the ambiguous circular nature of flirtation may be used as the defense against the losses and disappointments that come with intimacy and complexity, and the complexity of object love. And this view of flirtation as a defensive strategy that is used to ward off loss can be linked to André Green's critique of Winnicott's theory of play, which, as we've seen, is key to Phillips' reading of flirtation. Now, Green takes issue with what he sees as Winnicott's idealized reading of play as being rooted solely in, quote, a benign vision of the first mother-baby relationship. Instead, citing Beyond the Pleasure Principle, Green argues that play includes a sexual aspect to it and that it can be cruel, narcissistic, and destructive. For Green, destructive forms of play are not based on interchange, but on the will to dominate, and that this omnipotence can be very enjoyable. This description of play is evocative when applied to flirtation, obviously in its more manipulative guise, as a form of mastery over the object. These ideas, then, can be used to think about the flirtatious sensibility of the contemporary postmodern subject, when a flirtatious as-if attitude is developed as a defense against the losses and insecurities of intimacy and subjectivity today. We live in a highly mediatized promotional culture, where we dart from sensation to sensation, addicted to the image and the narcissistic pleasures of short-lived encounters. How does the jealous lover fare in a culture where, as Jones argued, flirtation may take hold as a narcissistic defense against the risks of attachment and the potential disappointments of loss associated with feelings such as jealousy? Well, I think that Steve McQueen's film, Shame, is suggestive in this context. The film is set in New York and stars Michael Fassbender, who plays a sex addict called Brandon, who takes flirtatious encounters to new levels in his obsession and search for anonymous sex, both in the flesh, so to speak, and online through pornography websites. Here we go. Here is Brandon in search of sex on the New York subway. And we've got a little clip here. Music. so many, it evokes so many narratives, sort of archetypal narratives, I don't think. Okay. The play of flirtation, lust and longing in that clip is mixed, I think. It begins by allowing us to imagine a mutual attraction between Brandon, Fassbender's character, and the woman in the scene. From the perspective of the spectator, the film also allows us to lust after Fassbender, to gaze at him as an object of desire. And I'm thinking here of Steve Neal's work on the spectacle of masculinity. And yet, the deferral of desire sustained in those early moments moves into something else. And the camera reinforces this with a shot that closes in on her cross legs, evoking perhaps a kind of sadism of the male gaze discussed by Laura Mulvey. And it's at this point, I think maybe the scene evokes Andre Green's description of play as being linked to omnipotence and the control of the object and the potential pleasures of identifying with Fassbender as an object of desire should also be seen in this context. So there's this sort of movement of things going on in the clip, and I know different people have different opinions about that clip. I've shown it, and I often get quite a mixed response. But as the reviewers argued, much of the film is bleak, and as the title suggests, it often equates desire and looking with excess and shame. The film hints about some shared childhood trauma between Brandon and his sister, played by Kerry Mulligan, and even some incestual desire between them. Now, in their book, Attachment and Subjectivity, Nicola Diamond and Mario Moroni have discussed the ways in which unresolved childhood trauma and attachment disturbances become sexualized in later life. And these ideas can be extended, I think, to the cultural level to think more broadly about the losses of hegemonic masculinity and about the current context of what is often called porn culture, where male desire is foregrounded and where anxiety about loss and attachment may be dealt with in the ways explored through the character of Brandon in the film. Now, Shame is a very good-looking film, and it brings to mind the sort of seductive aesthetics of postmodern advertising culture. And the interchangeability of Brandon's sexual encounters also evokes for us the processes of commodity fetishism. And in this respect, there are similarities, I think, between Brandon's attempts at mastery through his repetitive use of women as objects and the actions of the yuppie serial killer, Patrick Bateman, in Christian Bale's American Psycho. Now, Brandon's alienated state of mind is evoked through the part objects that populate the film, from images of his penis to the recurring motif of Brandon's rumpled duck egg blue sheets, much commented on actually by reviewers, and that are now also in show in the film's promotional poster. Now, Philip's benign view of flirtation as an interactive and playful activity is perhaps not really applicable to the representation of Brandon's nihilistic search for pleasure. Brandon can't sustain any attachment through his encounters with women. And for us, watching him, watching women, the gaze is continually equated with shame, addiction, disturbance, and misery. And the puritanical tone of McQueen's film, with its dystopian representations of Fassbender's flawed and unhappy personality, I think chimes in with masculinity in crisis films of the 90s, in its lament for the consequences of porn culture, where the different kinds of flirtation discussed by Phillips are foregone in pursuit of instant gratification of bodily desire with no concern for the erotic charge of communicating with real women. So this kind of melancholy was picked up by film reviewers like David Thompson, who, noting the similarity in their names, contrasted the character of Brandon unfavorably to Marlon Brando in The Last Tango in Paris. And he wondered why Fassbender agreed to walk around naked when Marlon would never have consented to such a thing. And the unpleasures for the male sex spectator then in this instant is also linked to the way in which the viewer were kind of positioned as objects to be tantalised throughout by the film's lack of resolution and the kind of flirtatious deferral which contradicts the potential pleasures of identifying with Fassbender as hunk and star with his duck blue egg sheets. So if flirtation has become a metaphor for the contemporary age where relatedness is lost and where the desire to look and know is augmented through new technologies of porn culture, then what happens to jealousy when it's always other than itself? What do men want if what they used to desire is everywhere and nothing is hidden? Well, a relationship with a computer, if the film Her is to be believed. And I'm aware it's 25, I think we've got 5 minutes, yep, 5 minutes. Well, I think the important thing is to show you the images and we can, you know. Have any of you seen this film, Her? That we'll see. We'll just show a little clip and...
Hey, Samantha.
How was it? Hey there.
Hey, Samantha.
How was it?
Not so good. That's kind of weird, actually.
That's too bad.
How are you doing? What's going on with you?
Not much. I'm okay. Fine.
Yeah? Don't sound like it. Is there anything you want to talk about?
I don't know. What's it like? What's it like to be alive in that room right now?
What do you mean?
What do you... Tell me everything that's going through your mind. Tell me everything you're thinking.
Well... Okay. Well, the room's spinning because I drink too much because I wanted to get drunk and have sex. There's something sexy about that woman. Because I was lonely. Maybe just because I was lonely. I wanted somebody to fuck me. I want somebody to want me to fuck them. Maybe that would have filled this time. A little hole in my heart, but probably not. And sometimes I think I've felt everything I'm ever gonna feel. And from here on out, I'm not gonna feel anything new. Just lesser versions of what I've already felt.
I know for a fact that is not true. I've seen you feel joy. I've seen you marvel at things. I mean, you just might not see it at this exact time, but that's understandable. You've been through a lot lately. You lost a part of yourself. I mean, at least your feelings are real. I don't know. It's, never mind.
No, wait, what? Tell me.
I'm stupid.
I want to know. Tell me.
It's just that earlier I was thinking about how I was annoyed, and this is going to sound strange, but I was really excited about that. And then I was thinking about the other things I've been feeling, and I caught myself feeling proud of that, you know, proud of having my own feelings about the world, like the times I was worried about you, and things that hurt me, things I want. And then I had this terrible thought. Like, are these feelings even real? Or are they just programming? And that idea really hurts. And then I get angry at myself for even having pain. What a sad trick.
You feel real to me, Samantha.
Thank you, Theodore. That means a lot to me.
Roberto.
Yeah, I just want to get it done. Sign the paper.
Scene, that's where I've sort of, so just to sort of conclude then, I mean, I'll just to kind of finish up. I mean, what's interesting about that film is that it's significant, I think, that reality hits him when he first experiences jealousy. And there's a comic moment when he learns the limits of love and the limits of loving a computer. And he learns that Samantha has been interacting with 8,316 others. And that she's actually in love with 614 of them. And he's horrified. And in a reverse of the scene of shame that we just saw, he runs in this desperate, blind, jealous panic into the subway, goes down into the subway, and realizes he's not in control after all. So the director's playing with us, of course. But I mean, when I watched it, I felt for the guy, actually. I thought, blimey, what am I doing? But I did, I felt for him. So the uncertainties of desire, you know, were foregrounded for him and for us once more. And I think the film then doesn't collude with us in defending against those securities, but teases us continually. And I think what these both films show is in different ways, very different ways, is this sort of search for and evasion of intimacy. And it's about dealing with risk. And I think this is a kind of a wider existential problem. But I'm going to stop there because I know we need some time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Catherine. It's very interesting. I think her is the perfect contemporary romance.
Yeah, yeah.
It takes the small trips. Jane, do you want to come back so we can have a little bit of a conversation,
yes,
and questions?
I just need my stuff.
But it's very interesting how these two talks segue into really thinking about romance and what romantic love is. And I think, I mean, from while you all assemble your questions after watching that film, I mean, I think for me there's a slight distinction perhaps to be made between flirtation in the Philippian sense,
yes,
which is, I think, playful, and it happens in language,
yeah,
and seduction, which can happen both in language and in all these other ways as well, and feels much heavier somehow, mm-hmm, or at least has had, yeah, historically heavier repercussions. But over to you, and I don't know whether you have questions of each other to start with, and then we'll go to the audience. We've got about 10 minutes.
Well, I've got one, because I was, as I was playing that scene and having just heard your talk, I was very interested in the, I mean, it's got operatic, that scene in the subway.
Yeah.
And you know, the music, and then it's like a dance almost, isn't it? And you could almost sort of see it as a ballet at that moment, but also kind of real and parody, that romantic search and searching for her and looking and she's gone. And and when there's links with Courtney Love or what have you.
Also, what struck me was how, when she did actually get up from her seat and was drawn to him, that their faces were both serious, the seriousness of love. It was almost religious, you know, that there was something sort of devotional about that. Yeah. That was interesting.
Yes, yes.
It's a great clip.
But I also know that I've shown that and in the past and had a kind of quite an angry response from some women who've seen it and see it as reinforcing a kind of possessive male gaze and even a kind of rape fantasy, you know, kind of following her and chasing her and romanticising a kind of something which has actually got more sinister undertones.
I think there's danger.
Yes,
in the
there's danger.
Inevitably.
Mm. Yes. Mm.
Which, and you don't have the danger in her in some same way. I mean, it's almost a therapeutic situation, isn't it?
Yes, and the doctor and love.
With, you know, the voice being crucial to it.
Yeah.
So, questions there, Bob?
I'm sure this may be out of order, but I want to pay. Hello. I can make myself heard.
So you're talking something.
We can hear you.
Yeah.
Hello. Spoiled the moment. But anyway, I want to pay a compliment to Jane for her presentation. I was absolutely thrilled by it. The way she wore her learning lightly and had a kind of Joyce Grenfell shrug every few seconds to let us know that she wasn't showing off, and I would give anything to be able to imitate it. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
So, thank you, Bob. Now, a question back there. Or a comment.
I was just going to say, if we're talking about Olympia and virtual lovers, if you've seen Ex Machina yet, and if you've got any thoughts on that.
I haven't seen it yet, and I saw it. It was being referred to in a kind of collection of films to see this Valentine's, and I sort of made a mental, oh God, I should see this quickly. But it's interesting that that film and this actually her and even Shane was mentioned in a kind of I think it was on the Metro or something where they kind of had these must see films which are of the moment. I mean, do you have thoughts about that film in terms of how it links to the films that we've seen here?
I think it ties in very much with the idea of flirtation and control and who is controlling who in those situations.
Thank you.
I think what's interesting in a way to consider, and it's just occurred to me, I mean, I don't know whether you've thought about this, but there's a real sense in which flirtation is something that is more difficult to do online than it is in person. So, I mean, flirtation in the courtly tradition would be writing poems as well as sitting in on the court of love. I mean, it happens in language. And you can do a little bit of that online, but it forecloses it very soon. Whereas if you're sitting in a room with real or even in this virtual situation where it's just the voice, there's an awful lot of foreplay or flirtation.
It is interesting that in the film Her, his job is actually writing letters of love for other people. They're sort of outsourcing their emotions. And I've spoken to some of my students about this and flirtation, because there are all these dating sites and apps and so on. And they've actually said, well, kind of going against what I'm trying to say, actually, but they were like, well, it's really hard to flirt properly. I think we've lost the art because it's so instrumentalized now. You go to something, click, and it takes you to something else and something else, or you've got a kind of shopping list that you tick. And it sort of lost as well the spontaneity, and you can just stop.
I think what's worrying is with the problem on American campuses now. It's becoming ridiculous, the whole thing about sexual harassment and everything. And there are some campuses where apparently you have to sort of fill in various sort of little tick boxes of what you're prepared to go in for sexually. And that is just, I mean, you know, if anything is going to de-eroticize sex. But plus, I think also, I hate tales from young people of just sort of, you know, do you want a shag or can I snog you? I mean, that again, I'm sorry to be crude. I find that unbelievably crude. The point is that it should be surreptitious. I mean, you know, the best sort of sexual prelude is arguing about Luther on salvation by faith and salvation by grace, and just sort of, I mean, this happened to me once. It was absolutely marvellous because you know your intellect is engaged in one thing, and your loins in another, and you're just sort of, you know, you're just manoeuvring them into position. But also apropos the sort of the well, not quite. Forget that. But also the thing about. Because during candidates talk, Lisa mentioned the Andreas de Capellanus, which is the Arte Honesti Amandi, the art of courtly loving. And this was a text which was written in the 12th century, and he was at the court of Marie de France, and it was all about courtly love. And what's interesting is that's both used as a... Sorry, I mustn't get into my courtly love strike. But the point is, it's all dialogues between different... A man and a woman of different class. So sometimes it's a high-born woman with a low-born man with a high-born woman. And it's all about how to seduce one another. One of the three books of The Art of Courtly Love is about that. And that sort of flirtation in a way, it's sort of flirtation with a view to seduction. It's a sort of persuasive argument. And of course there are lots of epistolary novels like Eloise, the new Eloise by Rousseau, and of course writing can be very seductive.
Absolutely. I could just say one thing in relation to what you had said earlier, and it comes into what we were talking here, and your students and the difficulty of your first relationships perhaps being online relationships, and that is that we have a very different sense of where obstacles come in.
Yeah.
I mean, if everything is readily available as it is in a supermarket and you know, you click on it and you get it. There is no development of a capacity for yearning. And there are no obstacles in play which actually create, I think, and deepen what we would call love. I don't even want to use the term romantic, but of course romantic comes into it. Maybe this is something that will be taken up this afternoon as well. And I think Freud said, where there are no obstacles, there is no love. Because
where does he say that?
I can't remember now. It's in my book.
I don't buy my book.
I can't remember anything anymore. But I know we're kind of rushing, and I take two more questions and then let you just perhaps... if there are two more questions.
Yes, there was one there.
We'll take one more, and then you can both perhaps give us your thoughts about modernity.
Thank you very much for wonderful talks. I have seen Shame, and the one figure, of course, that is haunting from that film is the sister.
Yes.
You know, and she is the one who takes the shame.
Yes.
She's the one who is sort of filled with the shame, and meanwhile, he's enabled to at least have some kind of quest. And what I think is interesting is that there is a level of flirtation that goes on between the brother and sister, which for me is more real than anything else.
Yes.
You know, and there's something very tender about that.
Yes.
And what they're not doing is sitting down and getting help with this incestuous relationship that they clearly have.
Yeah.
Whether or not it's physical doesn't really, doesn't matter really. Yeah. I mean, you know, and then I went to see a film yesterday, it's just come out, Love is Strange, which is about two sort of older gay men. And it's a wonderful sort of depiction of sort of love, flirtation, that actually has sort of developed over the years between these two men. But it did strike me that it would be very difficult to make a film possibly about two women, older women, having that kind of relationship, you know. Anyway, thanks.
Thank you, that's really... Okay, I mean, we've got our speakers from the first panel on the Greeks as well, and perhaps we'll just allow for a few sort of rounding up thoughts for the morning and then have lunch and you can come back fresh in the afternoon with more questions. Shall we go in reverse order? Do you have any sort of final thoughts, having been through romance, seduction and flirtation?
Maybe one thing about this issue of courtly love. So the issue of courtly love and the issue of control in Chaucer, that I think a lot of that discourse comes out of Ovid. Ovid's Ars Amatoria and Ovid's love writing. And a lot of Ovid's love poetry is about men and women in battle with one another. And not ever being reciprocal. And so there's a kind of longer classical history to courtly love, and it definitely comes out partly out of Ovid, I think. So.
Yeah. No, exactly. Sorry. That was an omission, and I'm glad you said that. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
But also the myth of Psyche and Eros. I mean, in a sense, that plays into romantic love as well. I think. Into romantic love. Psyche and Eros, don't you think?
Oh, Psyche and Eros, but that's not in Plato.
No, I didn't say
no. No.
Antiquity.
Right.
The myth of Psyche and Eros.
Yeah.
Please, whoever. Eleanor, do you? Candida. Any final thoughts? Sorry, I'm rushing you.
Well, I just think they're very alive. The kind of wish for courtly love and the desire. And I was thinking, actually, the preoccupation, going off piste a bit here, but with Anne Boleyn and her story and her as a kind of myth and Henry VIII, because in fact, as you were talking, I was thinking about that depiction of her enacting that, wanting that. I mean, our interpretation of her wanting that and so on, and Wolf Hall and stuff, but the kind of huge preoccupation with the whole Anne Boleyn industry at the moment in terms of her lovers and her desire and how she played with Henry VIII or not, and the kind of fantasies around that. And it says something about us and a kind of wish for something, as well as deconstructing it at the same time. It kept coming to mind. Mm.
Well, also, I think it's important, the idea, which is so bothers so many of these ghastly men in dresses who are clerics, and that is that women should have desire at all.
Yeah.
You know, and that's got to be accommodated in all the sort of forks of these different, you know, ideas of love.
Yes. And of course, for the contemporary, the fact that the woman has desire has now moved to the next stage. I mean, how do we locate desire and reproduction within the same entity? But maybe more of that this afternoon. All right, thank you all very much. You have time for lunch. I'm proud of you.